What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, John Krofcik and Larry Rifkin. And John, we love to bring these topics that really are not in public view, and this one certainly is not, but is having a major impact on what goes on across the world. And I'm talking today about illicit trade. And evidently, this whole sphere has been growing exponentially in the last 30 years, in part because of the rise of new technology and the dark web.
Wow, you know, you don't hear dark web. That sounds kind of scary right there. But you don't hear about this. This is news to me.
Well, it has illicit trade all across the globe, even in places that might be considered rural and third world-like. There is so much poaching going on. There is so much trading of valuable commodities that you would never have imagined. Some of them are animal involved. Some of them relate to precious metals. I mean, it's just remarkable what's going on out there. And this woman who we have with us today, Louise Shelley, has written a book called Dark Commerce, How a New Illicit Economy is Threatening Our Future. And she makes a really profound case that this affects all of us in so many different ways that we don't understand. And it does affect the value of things. It affects the cost of various items. And in many ways, we don't understand the supply chain across the world. And sometimes this illicit activity is melded into what is otherwise a reputable chain.
Wow. I'm speechless here because, you know, you don't hear too much about how, but you're right, this could affect prices and everything, the way things are traded across the you know.
And there's also the fact that she brings up, I think so eloquently, that there's a lot about the sustainability of the planet that is being affected, because a lot of the things that are being traded in this illicit pipeline are things that are not going to enhance the climate and the environment across the world. Now, she'll explain that. That's a little complicated, but she does just an incredible job. So if you're somebody who cares about the economy of the world, you want to know how things get moved across the globe, and you really always wondered whether this dark commerce exists, trust me, Louise Shelley will explain it all today on America Trends. Louise Shelley is with us on America Trends. The book is called Dark Commerce, How a New Illicit Economy is Threatening Our Future. And dark commerce, it sounds so mysterious, and it sounds age old. I mean, when we think of piracy going back many, many years ago, are we talking in that realm, Louise?
The book starts off in Mesopotamia with Hammurabi's Code, which is about 1750 BC. And one of the provisions of this first recorded legal code in history is a provision against fencing, that is, trade in stolen goods. So from the first moment that we have prohibitions against human behavior, we have people trading in stolen property. And for 4,000 years after Hammurabi's Code, we have had an illicit trade based on personal relationships, tangible goods, and currency, because people would be paid for their illicit goods in either money or gold and silver. And in the last decades, this has changed. But this is not a new phenomenon.
So it's part of the human condition.
Absolutely. In fact, in my research on the counterfeiting part of it, I was found that there was counterfeiting not only in the ancient Roman Empire, but one would find it among the Aztecs, who had no contact with the Roman Empire. So human nature seems to be involved in illicit activity no matter where they are.
The difference between illegal trade and illicit trade. You say that there is a definitional distinction.
There is. So, for example, we have drug trafficking, human trafficking, firearms trafficking. These are all illegal activities and fall under the UN Convention on Transnational Organized Crime, to which the preponderance of countries in the world are signatories. Illicit trade is something that's a little more vague or less well-defined. So it can include these acts that we know of transnational crime, but it can also include things like ancient coins, which if they were dug up before 1970, can be legally traded, and those that are now dug up under contracts from the ISIS in Syria and Iraq are clearly illegally obtained. And yet they both may be present in the same stores or the same websites online.
You say that in the last three decades, the most advanced forms of illicit trade have broken with all historical precedents, which we've been talking about. Explain what that means.
Well, as I said, since the time of Hammurabi, human beings are trading intangible goods with money and they know each other. But now illicit trade, like that of other forms of legal trade, has gone online. But what's different is that many people who are trading in the most advanced forms of illicit trade are trading in property that is not even tangible. Things that people don't necessarily think about, like malware and botnets and trojans that are based on algorithms. But it's these goods that are being sold, often in the dark web, that are what are hijacking people's computers, stealing their identities, entering into their bank accounts, and, you know, robbing them of their money. And in this last stage of illicit trade, not only is it anonymized and does it deal with non-tangible goods, but people are often paying for it in cryptocurrencies, such as Bitcoin, which is the most noted, but some others that are more highly criminalized. And so people are not dealing with money that's backed by states or gold or silver that have inherent wealth wealth attached to them, but to these things that exist only in the cyber world as currency.
And yet, we've had guests on this podcast talking about blockchain, and they've said that blockchain, which undergirds all this cryptocurrency, really gives us a public audit of where the money comes from and gives people more confidence than many of the institutions like banks and other financial intermediaries that have lost a lot of favor over the years, like they did in America during the financial crisis.
I mean, I've written about blockchain in the book, but I'm not quite as optimistic about it because blockchain applies to Bitcoin, but to some of these much more criminal currencies that you have, like Liberty Reserve and Ethereum, they are not really, they do everything to disguise their origins, their transfers, and this is not something where blockchain has been extremely helpful in protecting us against the most criminal abuses of the cryptocurrency world.
Anonymity would seem to be vital in various of these endeavors like child pornography, narcotics, sex trafficking. Is that the case?
Absolutely. In fact, anonymity is also important in selling counterfeits, of selling illicitly harvested trees. It's important and essential to everything that is going on online and which are trying to obfuscate the origins of the product and where the money is going. But it is especially important in regards to these most sinister illegal activities.
I think you make a compelling case in your book, Dark Commerce, that in fact the environment of the world, now a lot of people might think about some of these other things as being horrific human acts in terms of stealing of human beings and, you know, entering young people into child prostitution, whatever it may be. But the fact that we're destroying our environment by virtue of some of these activities is something I don't think people would necessarily tie together with dark commerce.
I think that that's one of the major innovations of my book, is to show how these phenomena are all linked. Just as we have people engaged in what's called IUU fishing, which is unauthorized fishing, which contributes to 20% to a third of all the allegedly wild-caught fish imported into the U.S. Some of this fish is caught by trafficked individuals, because when boats are caught by foreign countries, they can just abandon the laborers. Sometimes the fish are used to transport drugs, because if they smell, people pass on them, and therefore the drugs can get through. So we're seeing a convergence of both this illicit trade in the products of the environment with other forms of very harmful commerce. But what I think is especially important to understand it is these products that are in the environmental world that are growing at the fastest rate of most forms of illicit commerce, growing 5 to 7% a year. And one of the things that I point out is that transnational crime or criminal groups have always been active in ports. If you think about the U.S., they were involved in the Fulton fish market, where they got the fish and they served it. They've been involved in Marseille and Vladivostok and Naples. And that's because if you don't unload a boat with cargo that can perish, you've got a problem on your hands. And so they've always functioned in what I call time-sensitive industries. But now we have a time-sensitive planet with not enough resources for where many people are living. And therefore, hijacking these resources and going after them has become a prime commodity and revenue source for illicit actors.
And I think you make it very clear that many of these illicit products go through the same pipelines that are used for legitimate products and sold by the same vendors. So how is anyone to really uncover, what's illicit and what's licit trade?
That's an extremely difficult problem, and that's why there needs to be much more focus on supply chains and corporations being much more careful about understanding their supply chains. And this is where blockchain can have a much more active role in helping monitor the shipments and the containers and the way that these products move. Part of the problem is that we have so many free trade zones where containers are not inspected that it is possible to move illicit products around the world with great facility.
The dark web, you talk about that in your book, and we all have heard of Guccifer 1, and then Guccifer 1 is taken out by regulators, and Guccifer 2 comes on, and it's even more heinous in terms of what's being sold and the like. But explain in the most basic terms, what is the dark web?
So the dark web are the inner workings of the World Wide Web that can only be entered by special software, such as Tor, which you can download from the web. And once you go into the dark web, you are anonymized. No one knows who you are, where you're entering it. But when you get into the dark web, you have a problem because there's no Google, there's no search engine that allows you to negotiate within the dark web. So you have to know an address, like an onion address, of where you're going to find illicit commodities that you seek. So sometimes you can find clues on social media. People post on Reddit or others sort of advertisements for commodities like drugs that are sold on the dark web. And that's how people know where to find them once they've used Tor to get in there.
And who are the people who go onto the dark web? I mean, who understands Tor and who takes a tour of the dark web?
Unfortunately, there are many bad actors who are doing that, and people who are looking for drugs are also entering into this world. So there is billions of business being conducted. The first large online platform, which was Silk Road, that was taken down after 2 years, and that was about 5 years ago, had done $1.8 billion worth of business in 2 years. And its successors have done multiples of that. So there is certainly a large customer base functioning in the darkest elements of the Internet.
And who is there to regulate any of this activity? What kind of international agreements or instruments are used where countries come to this and say, we must prevent this because it's hurting us on so many different levels, whether it's taxation, whether it's the environment, whether it's just human degradation? Where is the internationalization of this as a problem?
Okay, let's go back and look at this question of the dark web, where there's nobody regulating that. When we get to the surface web, we have problems in the United States in that under an obscure part of our commercial code, we have no responsibility of online platforms such as Amazon or Google or Facebook to be responsible for what they're presenting. So we're not even having regulation of what we're making accessible to people, whether it's online,
yeah, that's a great
counterfeit pharmaceuticals and others. Other products that we have functioning in dark commerce are regulated by international protocols. We've had the Montreal Protocol that tries to regulate chlorofluorocarbons and things that are being released into the air. We've got the CITES Convention that has tried to regulate trade in endangered species. We've got the Transnational Convention on Transnational Organized Crime that deals with its sub-protocols on human trafficking and on drugs that requires governments to criminalize this activity and pursue it. But we have no one body that is responsible for policing this, for overseeing all the parts of dark commerce that are now threatening our future in so many complex ways.
You remind us that the world's sixth greatest extinction is underway, and it's being fueled by a lot of this activity. And you devote an entire chapter to the illicit rhino trade. Why don't you use that as an illustrative case?
I'd be delighted. And it's very sad because spending time in South Africa, observing the rhino, observing the people who are living in Skukuza, which is where the patrol and the military presence is in South Africa trying to protect the rhino, has brought to home how acutely all our efforts to save this animal that's been on Earth for tens of millions of years are not really helping. And we've stemmed the exponential growth in it, but we're still, within 10 years, we've gone from a trade in rhino that was about 7 rhino being killed a year to now about 1,200. And at this rate, the genetic pool be severely hampered, and the future of the rhino is at stake. Part of it is that individuals around the parks, like Kruger, where the rhino is still living, are not very concerned about whether the rhino survives, because not much has been tied to the economic interests of the community, and the tourists that come to look at it are not seen as a benefit to the people who live around the parks where the rhino are located. On the other end, in China, in Vietnam, there's an enormous demand for rhino horn trade. So you have these two worlds that are thousands of miles apart, where you have a new middle class, a new wealthy class, that desires natural medicines or sees the rhino as a cure to cancer for which it is not, but government officials, probably bribed by the rhino traders in Vietnam, have proclaimed that this is a cure for the for their cancers, who are ready to spend large amounts of money to procure this horn that is becoming scarcer and scarcer. And many of the people who are engaged in this trade don't perceive it as something that should be criminalized because they don't respect these laws. And I call this trade dysfunctional selection.
Yeah, explain that to us. I think it's an important concept.
Because under Darwin, we have this concept of how life has evolved on the planet, in which we're talking about natural selection, that the healthiest animals select themselves and survive. But now we've got a dysfunctional selection, where the largest elephants with the longest tusks, the healthiest rhino with the longest horns, are the ones that are being selected to die by human poachers. In fact, we now have an almost tuskless elephant that's evolved because of the threats to elephants of this poaching. And this selection, this dysfunctional selection, is eliminating some of the largest animals that are needed for the maintenance of the ecological systems in the region that they live. So their deaths are totally dysfunctional. And the individuals who are engaging in this poaching are also in a dysfunctional activity because they may be paid only $5,000 to kill the animal. But unused to that much money, they dissipate it. It's not used to create jobs. It doesn't secure the futures. It's something like being a drug trafficker. You know, you live high on the hog and then you die quickly. And so this whole process of killing off wildlife is dysfunctional for the animals and it's dysfunctional for the humans who are engaged in this trade.
Louise Shelley is with us. She's written the book Dark Commerce. And you tell us the trade in the commodities needed for human survival, trees, fish, wildlife, is the fastest growing form of illicit trade.
Unfortunately, it is. One thing that we're seeing now is water mafias that are present in India and Pakistan and Bangladesh and also in Central America.
And by the way, tell us what role these water mafias played in Syria around the time of the Arab Spring and perhaps the conflict that has ensued there that certainly has come to our consciousness.
I'm very glad you asked me about it because I think it's one of the most interesting and important case studies that I found for this book. So a little over a decade, when the present ruler of Syria's father was confronting a major drought in Syria that was affecting the breadbaskets of Syria, he prohibited digging deep wells because there was no water table to be tapped into. But the high levels of corruption of his regime led to people digging more and more wells. And soon there was no water left to irrigate the fields. And in a relatively short time, one of the largest, on a percentage basis, rural to urban migration occurred as millions left the Syrian countryside for ill-equipped cities. And some scientific research has shown that in those communities where the rural migrants arrived because of the corruption, no housing, no infrastructure to accommodate them, it is in these areas that the Arab Spring began. And we have what I call the domino effect, where one problem, such as illicit trade in water, has led to urban conflict, and then the mass migration that we're seeing of migrants from the civil conflict in Syria into Turkey, and some trying to move on to Europe, which is a human trade and a payment of human smugglers to move. So one form of illicit trade sets off many other problems that lead to other forms of illicit trade.
Very interesting. Does a lot of this trade emanate in the East and move west, or is that too much of perhaps a Western perspective that we're going from Dubai and the Balkans and the Black Sea westward, or is that not accurate?
Some of it is coming east, but a lot of, for example, the largest source of counterfeits of fentanyl is China, which is the biggest producer of everything for the world. So it's not as if it's moving from a developing world. It's moving from where mass production is going on, and the natural resources are going on for many developing countries where these natural resources exist. But we also have a problem that the money that's generated from this is moving into developed countries.
And are there many nation states? I mean, can we say that a lot of the pilfering that China has done, which is part of the beef that we have with China today about stealing intellectual property, that it permeates the culture in terms of getting involved in product that itself, whether it's software, whether it's intangible or tangible, is actually being encouraged by the nation state itself?
I think the clearest example of that is North Korea, which is a state that actually survives on illicit trade. But China has had, as I point out in the book, a long tradition of counterfeiting, I wouldn't say counterfeiting, of copying. And in Chinese tradition, this is seen as a form of flattery and not as a necessarily illicit activity. So culture, history, and tradition also shape illicit trade as we know it today.
You conclude by looking at the future of illicit trade, and we're always looking at trends on this podcast, where we're headed. So tell us, where does it go from here?
Unless we start working collectively on these issues, like we're trying to band together to address climate change, we are going to see an escalating growth in all of these phenomena, because there's nothing cohesively being done to stop them, and we keep looking and stovepiping our responses to each form of illicit trade, while the people acting in them just see each form of illicit trade as a business opportunity and move readily from one to the other. And the cyber world has allowed, through its anonymity, its cryptocurrencies, for this phenomenon to scale. Just as we're seeing less people walking into stores this Christmas and doing more of their shopping online, many people are doing this, and they're not always the most sophisticated consumers, and they're not aware that they may be buying counterfeit goods or products made of wood that where the trees should not have been cut down. So there needs to be a much more awareness among citizens of what they're doing and being much more responsible consumers.
And yet you tell us that there are many legitimate companies, manufacturers, maritime, transport, fishing, banks, real estate, financial, and we may be doing business with them thinking it's all above board, but it's not.
And that's a tremendous problem that we're facing today, is that we need much more transparency in the international financial system. We need to know something that's called beneficial ownership, because many of this illicit money is transferred globally. And for example, trees that were cut down on a mass scale in Borneo, the profits of this multi-billion dollar business, part of them wound up in the Lincoln Building in Seattle that rents out space to the FBI, our agency that is supposed to be fighting corruption. So we are all part of this problem. It's not as if it's one part of the world. We're all part of it. And it requires much more focus on supply chains and much more focus on following the money. And for consumers, asking corporations who are selling them products to be much more vigilant in understanding the supply chains that supply their goods that they're using. For example, coltan is a commodity that is often found in conflict regions in Africa, the same in Colombia. People need to be aware and requiring corporations, both legitimate ones, to be much more responsible about their sources of supply.
Louise Shelley, thank you for being with us today on America Trends. The book is called Dark Commerce: How a New Illicit Economy is Threatening Our Future. And you've done such a great job of sharing this content with us. I hope many people will pick up your book. Thank you again.
Thank you for hosting me. Bye-bye.
You're listening to America Trends Podcast, and we're part of the Mental Health News Radio Network at mhnrnetwork.com.